Good morning. Welcome to the February 2nd, 2021 meeting of the House K-12 Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings such as this are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members, you have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached to the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. If a member is on their phone and doesn't have access to the raise your hand feature, please email Ms. Burt and she will put your question in the queue. This is the digital equivalent of getting the attention of the chair or committee administrator. An email from your House account with the subject line, please recognize, is all that is required on your phone. Ms. Sunderland, would you please take a roll call?
Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Kreisha, present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski. Representative Drazkowski. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski. That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Thompson, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from our Thursday, January 29th meeting? And if so, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
Yes, sir, Chair. The approved minutes, and so moved, yes.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Any discussion to the Thompson motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes from our Thursday, January 29th meeting, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Thompson. Members, this week we're going to spend significant time on examining solutions that seek to reimagine school climate and culture as one strategic solution to helping close the racial disparities in Minnesota schools. Today, we're going to be hearing from a group of school administrators who have been engaged in this work, as well as a coach and trainer who focus on this work every day. We'll open with a presentation from two metro area superintendents involved with the Reimagine Minnesota work. One from the East Metro, one from the West, Superintendent Christine Tucci-Osorio, and from the North St. Paul Maplewood-Oakdale School District, and Superintendent David Law from the Anoka-Hennepin School District. Superintendent Osorio, are you up first?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Dabney and members of the House of Representatives. It's a true pleasure to be here this afternoon, or I guess it's still morning. It feels like afternoon. We're very excited to share with you a little bit of the background around Reimagine Minnesota, the work that's been happening, and also where we see our opportunities heading next after this work we're in right now. So with that, my colleague, Superintendent Law, is actually going to share his screen.
Just a second. I had this all ready to go, and I'll try one more time.
If you could both just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Dabney and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here today again speaking with you and sharing the work of literally dozens of my superintendent colleagues around the metro that we've been working on for, it's coming up on 5 years. And with this, I will present the reimagined work, and I'll let my colleague, Superintendent Osorio, kick it off.
Excellent. Okay. Are you sharing your screen at this time?
I'm not. I'm almost there.
Oh. Got it. All right. Well, as we get started, I just...
Osorio.
Yes. We're good to begin?
You are. Please. All right.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. As we get started, I just want to talk for a minute about why is this work critical. You've heard of this term, Reimagine Minnesota. We'd like to give you a little bit of a background of how this all got started. You know, we all know that our demographics in our state are changing rapidly. That's not a new secret to any of us. We believe that education is a leading indicator of not only how education is doing, but quite frankly, where our economy might be heading next. And if we have a real obligation to make sure that all of our students are fully educated, ready to be contributing to the workforce, and quite honestly, making our society a better place to be once we are leaving the world in their care. So this is a huge piece of our work. I'd like to go to the next slide, please. If you are new to looking at QR codes, I'm sure most of you are well aware, if you open up your camera and you aim it right at that QR code, whatever kind of smartphone you have, it'll take you to the same link because it's a lot to type out. This is just a reference to the Cruz Guzman versus State of Minnesota lawsuit. I'm sure you're all quite familiar with it, but it was a spark that inspired this beginning of this conversation. As we know, that lawsuit was filed in 2015. And at the time, metro area superintendents, we started talking with each other about, you know, how do we get ahead and do a better job of serving our communities of color? How do we do a better job of making sure we are raising culturally wise students of all races? And this is something we wanted to get started talking about. So I'm not going into the Cruz Guzman lawsuit, but it was quite frankly what started the conversation in the very first place of this. Next slide, please. So as we began the conversation of Reimagine, we decided it was important for us to go out and hear what our communities had to say about the future of our school districts and school in Minnesota as a whole. As an organization, AMSD, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, we got together. We hired facilitator Paula Forbes and Dario Otero to help with this facilitation. And we hosted 12 distinct community conversations all over the metro. And we were partnered together, often four or five school districts at a time. And we brought together all kinds of community members to really take a look at what our community had to say about the future of education in Minnesota. And what's so special about this is we had thousands of voices coming together to give us their thoughts and ideas. So this is not something that was created in a room with a group of superintendents. This came from the voices of our community. We had students pre-trained to be the facilitators of this work, and they adults hosted the space, but the students facilitated the conversation. Next slide. This was our purpose statement at the time, ensuring the fundamental right to an adequate education of all students. I won't get into all those details right now. Next slide. I know we don't have a lot of time, so I'm gonna go quickly, but you'll all have these for reference. These were the three community conversations, three questions we posed to our community. They were driven with our students as leaders facilitating those. What's your vision of an equitable, integrated, excellent education? What are the challenges we currently face? And what are some of the urgent changes we need to make in order to improve our system? Next slide. This is the business question we ask. What's changing in our communities and greater businesses that requires a change in the way we educate our students? And what barriers can our business and community partners help us to move out of the way so that we can do this work properly? So that was a really thorough and comprehensive conversation. This is a picture of what those community conversations look like. And remember, there were 12 of them across the metro, all over, all corners of the metro and in the urban core as well. It's just a beautiful, several months long of holding these community conversations. Next slide, please. At the time, we also hired Ann Gomez. She's a graphic recorder, and she's got an amazing skill and talent for visually recording what she's hearing in the room. And each one of these sessions came away with their own mural, separate mural, of those conversations and what they were hearing in the room. If you were to go to the AMSD website, you can see visuals of all of those as well. They're just beautiful, but they really tell a story of what was happening in those rooms when those conversations happened. Next slide. These were some, following our major conversations across the community, we did also hold a student conference at that time with 300 students. That helped, they were the facilitators, they came together, and then they had their own day-long retreat to tell us what they thought of the experience. And these were the key issues that they brought up as areas of concern and priority for education. So these were from those 300 students that were our room facilitators. Next slide. So as we look at this, this is where we talk about the goals that came out of the Reimagine Minnesota. And I believe this is where I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Superintendent Law, to carry on with kind of what came next after all of this.
Thank you, Christine. So after we gathered all that input, we wanted to make sense of it and put it into an action plan. It wasn't just enough to listen, but we wanted to move forward productively. And three overarching themes you can see on the screen: see every student, see every community member, serve all equitably, and support all students to be successful to the level of their need. And going through that process, we spent several months working with Metro leaders on what are some strategies that would make a difference based on this input. And you can see this list of strategies, and you have a copy of these, and we're going to dig into these. Cultural competence for educators, recruitment and retention, community bridges, personalized education, a center on student voice, a shared understanding among leaders and board members, cultural inclusivity and our curriculum, addressing adult behaviors that lead to discrepant results, and addressing statewide funding. And each of these have action plans within our plan. I share this link as a reference. After we came up with our plan, our partner, the University of Minnesota, said we'd like to research and see if these plans are likely to make a difference, if they're research-based. And there's a link to this and a QR code for you to check out. The short story is a lot of the things that our community members wanted are based in research and likely to be effective in making change in our school system. So we were fortunate to find out that we gathered community input and came up with strategies that will likely make a change. And I'm going to walk through just a couple examples. These slides are from a presentation actually a group of us did as part of the Cruz-Guzman mediation. This is specifically focusing on recruitment and retention. And this is the story of Minneapolis Public Schools and the steps that they made. They presented national research on the importance of teachers of color in our school system and the steps that they took and the challenges that they made. And I share this with you to show you that this isn't a plan on paper. This is a plan that was put into action. Some success across the metro in creating, supporting affinity groups, training school leaders, enhancing onboarding, refocusing teacher and school leader professional development. There's a lot of challenges with one, attracting people into the field, and then maintaining and mentoring people to stay in the field. And they gave some examples how to leverage funding to do that. There's a lot of legislative action on this topic too, and we're thrilled about that with the Reimagine Minnesota Leadership Group. Another strategy was cultural competence, develop, sustain, and evaluate cultural competence for teachers, something that we've been doing in public schools for a long time, but not a great job evaluating how effective we are. One of the districts that presented shared about building equity into professional development across all professional development, analyze the effectiveness and develop standards to evaluate this from a student lens, provide time and to support teachers' work, build expertise and competence through teacher collaboration, and train for culturally competent teachers approaching school-wide practices. I think the biggest hurdle with that is how we all evaluate who's culturally competent. And actually, there's some really exciting partnerships that are being formed right now with an organization that measures the effectiveness of your cultural competence as it's embedded in your school system. Several of us, including Anoka Hennepin, are forming that partnership, hopefully to have some hard data to show that it's moving the needle in this area. Here's some barriers that we've experienced. And certainly the dominant culture perpetuating the status quo, getting training and then going back into entrenched values and beliefs, something that we've experienced across all of our school systems and probably many government agencies. Because I'm sensitive to our time, you have these slides. I'm gonna skip to one more. Cultural inclusivity, one of the pieces our students and our community said is we wanna see ourselves in the materials presented to us. And so this is just specifically from Anoka Hennepin, I can speak to this one. Embed equity competencies into all curriculum. That's something that's referenced in the Due North plan from the governor recently. Hold high expectations for all and remove barriers that marginalize learners. And I'll just highlight a couple of these strategies. Some examples of how districts are doing this: create magnet opportunities at all levels to allow students to enrich by choice, use college or multiple supports for students to enhance college course taking, like College Possible or Avid, and offer a variety of course offerings based on student interest to enhance your curriculum. And I've listed a sample of those course offerings that are in our curriculum now that weren't there before, some of the reimagined work. Continuing to modify our materials based on student interest and aligning them to state standards as well. How do we measure success? You know, our ultimate goal is that engaged students who think their schooling meets their needs, attend school, perform, and feel prepared to be successful beyond high school. Graduation rates are an example that we use. And coursework, students that take college or career preparation coursework is another measure. Kids that are successful engage in things they're interested in that will lead to a productive life beyond high school. The last one I'll reference here is statewide funding. We have those conversations frequently at the Capitol, but it came up through our community listening sessions that there's a perception that there's inequitable opportunity for students. Here's some examples of that. It leads to instability and opportunity for students. And I'll leave these for your review.
If I could interject while you're flipping through
sure.
those slides, David.
Sorry,
thank you. What I was going to say is that, you know, in school funding, part of the problem is that we do have inequities. We're very largely based on local operating referenda to fund our schools. And we have a very firm belief, if we're talking about equality, equity in Minnesota, the quality of your education should not be dependent on your zip code as to how much value you have in property value in your school district. Another issue that exists in school funding, and you often hear us talk about the need for stabilization and predictability in school funding. Unlike, for example, municipalities, school districts, our fiscal year, as you know, goes July 1st to June 30th. So in a funding year like this one, it's hard for us to know without predictable funding, it's hard for us to be able to plan accordingly. And many of our contracts, labor contracts, require that people be notified by April or May if they're going to be laid off. We have to make all those decisions before we know how much our funding is going to be. And one of the reasons we often advocate for tying our funding formula to the rate of inflation is at least it would allow us some predictability there and help us to not lose, for example, some of our new staff of color that have been hired that have to be laid off if we're predicting that we may have a shortfall. Another area is, if you think about you've often heard about the cross subsidy, right, for special education and EL funding. But EL funding in particular, when it's not tied to the formula over the years, the formula can get an increase, a 2%, a 1%, a 3%, and EL funding does not unless it's acted upon separately. Tying those together allows us to have predictability in that area. And you know that it's significantly underfunded. It's a value to our state, not just for educational purposes, but the future of our economy if our workforce is well-educated in that regard. So as we go to the next slide, we'll let you read about all of this, and you can read our AMSE platform, which is very much informed by our Reimagine Minnesota work. But I want to just point out that as one of the co-chairs for the State School Finance Task Force, we very much leaned into these same values and principles when we worked in that area as well across many sectors. You'll find a lot of alignment between our AMSD and other professional organization recommendations, that group as well, the Governor's Roundtable, and of course the latest, the values the Governor has as well in his latest budget proposal. There's alignment across the board. There's growing energy sharing these values together. So just want to reference that as well. And just, you know that we did this together, but we didn't just do it in a vacuum. We listened to our students, we listened to our communities, and we're very much continuing to work together. There's never been a time in history where metro area superintendents talk to each other this much. It's pretty incredible. We are not, and we've also expanded this work to include many of our superintendent colleagues in greater Minnesota as well. David and I have both traveled around Minnesota to talk about these same core values and have felt a lot of resonance and people agreeing with the same issues out in greater Minnesota as well. So next slide, David, do you want to wrap it up with where we go from here?
So, as we were wrapping up last year and COVID took over almost all of our activity at the building level, There was a focus from district leaders and board members about how do we keep an equity lens during the pandemic. And daily decisions that are linked to student equity. So we met with board members and had a great conference last June just to keep equity on the mind. Something as simple as grading options for high school students. And does it count for your, when students didn't have technology or access to teachers, do we count that towards your cumulative grade point average and create additional inequity within our system? Or offering distance learning this year. And in my district, I can tell you there's a direct correlation between poverty and families' choice to do distance learning. And the same is true, schools that had higher percentage of students of color chose distance learning over in-person learning. And we have to be mindful of how do we make sure that that doesn't create further inequity within our system. Actually, we've also studied, we've got students that never did well in school, are thriving in distance learning, and what do we learn from that? How does that, those parents tell us that the distraction of school made it hard for their kids to learn. Now they're doing better. How do we create that? So in many districts, like in Anokanapin and others, we're creating a virtual school at the elementary and secondary level for those opportunities for those families that are finally thriving to say, oh, this will be an opportunity for you forever. We've also pushed our teachers to think differently about what really matters. And our students told us, we surveyed them in December and January, and our parents, and they said, our kids want relationships with teachers, even in a virtual setting. Take time to visit with us before you just start leaning in. The good news is our plan is flexible. Several of the key areas you'll see that from this plan are popping up in many other proposals, whether it be cultural competence or embedding multiple student voices in our curriculum or ideas for hiring teachers of color. All of those things are, we're thrilled to see, are embedded in legislative ideas and other initiatives. So the last piece is our plan is flexible. Depending on a district's greatest need, they can take the portions that are most relevant to them and work with other metro districts or statewide districts to move forward. So with that, we've gone over our time and we stand for questions, and we'll be around for this whole session to answer questions also.
Thank you, Superintendent Osorio. Thank you, Superintendent Law. Members, I'm not seeing any questions at this point. Oh, wait, no, I am. I'm sorry. Representative Erickson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, presenters. Very interesting. I marvel at the fact that you have these great successes, and yet you say you're underfunded. But my first question is for Superintendent Osorio. I was saddened to hear you say that you're forced to lay off teachers of color. Why is that? Is that our LIFO policy, or you know, what's driving that? That's mm-hmm. so sad to hear.
Superintendent Osorio.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, Representative Erickson. Oftentimes, I wasn't actually speaking just of teachers. I was just talking about staff in general. And yes, it is a lot of times in our contracts. We do have some of those same agreements where we're based on seniority, and when we do have cuts, sometimes those are the folks who are most affected by that. So yes, that would be part of the issue that we're facing in that regard.
Superintendent Erickson.
I'm a superintendent now. Thank you.
Oh.
Thank you.
I'm not even sure whether that's a, you know, a plus or a minus on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair. So, Superintendent Osorio, would you support the repeal of LIFO then?
Superintendent Osorio.
Oh, thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Erickson. I would certainly support an evaluation of it and a review of it to figure out some better ways that we can strengthen our language and recruitment and retention of staff of color.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Superintendent Law, in our state accountability statute, we have an excellent definition of cultural competency in that it's the interaction between educators and parents in regard to three areas, socioeconomic, native language, and race. And so I'm wondering, because you evaluate principals and you brought up the fact that you're looking for measures for cultural competency, do you know to this day whether or not principals are asking their teachers whether or not they follow that statute so that when issues arise between, let's say, a white teacher and an African-American parent about a custom, let's say, you know, are those issues resolved by that conversation that, you know, is spelled out in our state accountability section of law?
Superintendent Law.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. And Representative Erickson, I'll tell you anecdotally, there's a disconnect between what we offer and how we evaluate and how parents and students perceive. And that, getting to the heart of that is what we're working on. We've offered dozens of hours of training for our employees about how to be cultural competent, and they self-report it, and sometimes they show action. But I think in the moment of interaction, cultural insensitivity or cultural unawareness surfaces and they're addressed. We're just not, I'm not confident. Actually, I'm confident in the other direction. There's still a lot of work to do because we still have parents and students reporting a disconnect.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
One last question. You know, do principals hold their staff, particularly teachers, to the code of ethics? Because we heard in testimony criticism of teachers teaching in a discriminatory way or treating in a discriminatory way. And I'm very, you know, very disappointed to hear that because, you know, the first point in the teacher code of ethics is that delivery is made in a non-discriminatory way. So is the teacher code of ethics still important, you know, to principals as they work with their staff?
I believe it is. Thank you, Chair Debney. Excuse me. I believe it is, and I believe that as those issues are raised, our administration address them. People are human, and I don't think that being aware of those rules makes them eliminate those problems. I think we're just it's an ongoing process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Superintendent Law, Representative Erickson raises an interesting area of cultural competence and the interaction between teacher and student, and raised the question of overt discriminatory acts by a teacher to a student. Is that all it is? Is it just that I'm using disrespectful language in the classroom, or are the issues around cultural competence broader, deeper, different than that?
Chair Dabney, I think it's much more complicated than that. The incidents of overt discrimination and racism are much more rare than microaggressions or something as simple as not, I'll give an example of lowering expectations for a student in a classroom or not supporting them under the assumption that they don't want to work, or giving one group of students who are traditionally successful in school the benefit of the doubt that they probably had their homework done, and giving another group of students a critical comment that they don't have their homework again. It's the nuances of being in a classroom and relationships, and you know, implicit bias plays a role in that. So it's they're complex interactions based on learned experiences that we're trying to unlearn, and we're trying to get rid of some of that implicit bias. And it takes a lot of patience. And we're all aware on issues of race, tensions get high quickly. The minute that you tell someone you're being racially insensitive, people put up barriers and might not hear any coaching that happens. It takes a skilled administrator or coach to address someone on a perceived racist act in a classroom where it's a productive outcome, rather than retreating. This is hard work, but it's possible, and there are pockets of success. It's hard work.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Joachim, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. First, I want to thank both the testifiers and all the folks that worked on Reimagine for the hard work you've done to put the report together. Not only that, but to bring it out to the public and discuss it and present it and kind of walk the talk, seeing both of you do that in your districts, and that's greatly appreciated. Wondering when it comes to teachers of color, the Teachers of Color and Indigenous Act bill is a very big umbrella that's trying to make and create systemic change. While I know that is something that's aspirational, I know that districts have worked really hard individually to try to do what they can to increase the teachers of color in their ranks. Wondering if there's been situations where, not just with teachers of color, but newer teachers, where you've been able to have some flexibility to negotiate to try to keep teachers there and mentor them and support them, because we also know that that is a huge part of it, is that mentorship.
Superintendent Osorio.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Joachim. Great question, and absolutely. There's all kinds of ways that we do our best to make sure that we don't lose good talent when we have it. The other thing we have to really be honest and realistic about is that hiring staff of color into a position, if they arrive in a position where they themselves are racially isolated, we have to have a real honest conversation about what that means to be racially isolated in a community or in a work environment. And so I think part of, I'm just going to speak to, you know, the idea that, you know, I think it was the governor's presentation recently talked about an ethics study course being required for students. Many districts are considering that. We can't keep fixing the problem of racial discrimination and unconscious bias by only working with people of color. We have to talk about white students who become adults. We have to talk about white folks in the community. And I say this because back to the earlier answer that Superintendent Law was providing as well. Sometimes it's not overt. It's not overt racism that happens, but it's unconscious bias. And I would just encourage, if any of you want to actually have a conversation, we don't have a lot of time today, but I would love to talk through real life examples of how this plays out in school systems. And with no intention by anybody to do harm, but that unconscious bias can cause harm if it's not talked about and brought to the surface. And how do you do that in a way that actually is loving and supportive so that it's not a gotcha and a blame game? We have got to have honest conversations. And I would love to get into some more examples of what that actually looks like and play how it plays out from many of my years of experience and cool learning that has actually happened. So I just want to throw that out there. But I do agree that this is something we have to be really mindful of. Just recruiting, we have to ask ourselves, why are people of color not going into the education profession? What are we doing? There are lots of leaders and teachers of color in some other states outside of Minnesota. And so rather than just recruiting from our HBCUs, what do we do to make sure people who arrive here are actually supported and welcomed and nurtured, especially if they are brought into, and maybe we need to think really twice about putting people into racially isolated environments themselves. But there's a lot of layers to this that we have to be thinking about in the way we organize this. It's not just a waving a wand, hiring people of color, and then great, they're there. We need to have people feel like they want to stick around.
Representative Joachim, any follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for that, to really name that it's a lot more complicated than it sounds, and it's mm-hmm. not, there's no easy solutions that are out there, and that we all are evolving, mm-hmm. and that we need to continue to evolve. So thank you so much.
Representative Thompson.
Chair, thank you so much. Hey, I heard teacher of color at least, I documented at least 15 times. It's almost like taking my fingers and scratching it on the chalkboard, because what's the opposite of a person of color? And the real problem here, Chair, is you're right, culture. She said Superintendent Osorio. We're not hiring Black teachers. We're not hiring Black administrators. And so when we talk about cultural competence, like, you can't keep hiring white women to teach Black history, nor mm-hmm. can you hire Hispanic men to teach Native studies. Like, come on, man. There are kids in our school districts that are being suspended for being kids. They're sizing these kids up for their prison jumpsuits in kindergarten. This is like, I'm gonna call it like flat out. We're not doing a good job. I don't know if it's the human resource department in these schools, but there are plenty educated Black scholars, teachers, administrators that get overlooked. And that's why we have an achievement gap. That's why we have kids getting suspended. I'm talking about Black kids. I'm not gonna say kids of color. I'm mm-hmm. talking about Black kids, Black teachers, Black administrators. We don't have a lot of them. And it seems like people look the other way. And then we're here saying, well, we need to fix this problem. You know, people of color are not suffering like Black kids. People of color, I watch people of color benefit from white privilege. And I'm just gonna call it, and I'm not apologizing for my brash delivery, because my kids suffer from this corrupt system. You know, we call it education system. My kids watched Roots, Alex Haley, and they watched on Roots African Americans getting beat for learning how to read and write. This is our history. And here we are right now, they call it an achievement gap. They just don't have a whip. They call it an achievement gap right now. And so I'm always down to sit down and talk about lived experience, but also my experience as an African-American man and my kids. And I'm gonna always speak up because my kids suffer from this bogus system. And then we sit here and we say, well, we've done a study. How do you study Black people? You know, like, I don't get it without the people who you're studying being at that realm of your study. And so, like, I just want to make sure that we're having a serious conversation, because it starts with the way you hire. I mean, come on, some of these school boards look like the Target Corporation. So I just want to make sure that I'm serious about fixing the problem with education, because our future depends on it. And I just don't want to have a conversation about it. Like, I want action, to be honest with you guys. Like, I don't want to talk about it. And I, for one, know how to fix the problems in my community, because I've lived in it all my life.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Superintendent Osorio, any response?
I just wholeheartedly, Representative Dabney and Representative Thompson, I wholeheartedly agree. I think it is about really taking a look at the system. And, you know, for me personally, my hiring, I've been really going after. Many times we hire people of color or Black people into paraprofessional roles. I've been really focusing on putting our people of color into principal roles, who do the hiring, right? And that allows, it's made of, we've put a lot of our energy into making sure leaders of color are the folks who are the focus of our energies, because I do feel like people are more likely to go work in a school if they feel like there's a boss who looks and reflects their identity and that they can go to and know this is a safe space to be real and be myself. So I do wholeheartedly agree.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Kreisha, last question before move on
understood.
To our next panel.
So just very quickly, Superintendent, thank you for the conversation, and I appreciate us using the racial lens and focusing on that. Can you also tell me about how you would apply a quality lens and how you would make sure that we're hiring on the front of cultural competency, as well as making sure we're moving quality to the front of that issue, because a teacher that doesn't perform well can also be very detrimental to the students and have long-lasting effects. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to get that in quickly.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha, for the question. Representative Osorio, Superintendent Osorio, Superintendent Law, if you want to jump in, you certainly may as well.
I'll just say quality is a very subjective term. And there's a lot of ways we measure quality. We have standards of teaching, standards of effective practice, but I think you can never measure the quality of somebody's cultural competence if you aren't talking to the students and the families to see what their perception of that is. And I'll let Superintendent Law add on if he wants to say something about that.
Well, our ultimate goal is to get kids graduated successfully and have them participate in rigorous coursework. And we've got a series of state assessments that monitor progress. That's one tool we have. We also measure student engagement and parent satisfaction. So we've got a couple of data points where we ask kids, and you know, I visit with kids personally, what's your experience like? And kids are very real. So we have Superintendent Osorio and myself, and most of them are our district, we have tangible measures to look at effective teaching based on, you know, how well do students do at the end of the course? How well do the students do on their advanced placement tests or other things? We've got measures that show the effectiveness of teachers in addition to some of the other tools we're looking at.
Thank you, Superintendent. Members, I'd like to move on to our next panel at this point, and I think we're actually at a very good pivot point for these next two presenters. They're both good trouble principals. Principal Emily Piper from Washburn High School in Minneapolis, and Principal, I'm going to pronounce it Cherie, I hope that's right, my apologies if it's not, Jackson, Principal at the Robbinsdale Middle School. If you both will, welcome to the committee, if you'll both introduce yourself for the record before you speak and then proceed with your testimony, please do.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dr. Emily Palmer. I'm the proud principal of Washburn High School in Minneapolis and a board member of the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak with you today. I'm going to go first and cover a couple pieces, and then Principal Jackson will continue. Good Trouble Principals is a coalition. It's not an organization. We're just an informal group of like-minded principals and assistant principals who are focused on racial equity work in our schools. The group's origin goes back to last March when we first went into lockdown. And some principals in Minneapolis started talking about how not to go back after COVID, instead of backward to go forward, and use the crisis to change the system for the better, and started visioning what was possible. Then after Congressman John Lewis died, Mari Frieslaven, principal at North High School in Minneapolis, had the Good Trouble idea and suggested writing a statement and signing our names to it. An informal group of us worked on drafting and revising the statement, which I put into the chat so you can see on our website the full statement. It was intended first as just a commentary piece for the Star Tribune. Then we reached out to colleagues across the metro who we knew were significantly involved in racial equity work to invite them to sign it with us, and ended up with about 180 signatures in like one weekend. As you're probably aware, it got a lot more media attention than we had expected. Mari then created a private Facebook group as a way to keep us connected, and the Good Trouble website and our other social media kind of grew from there. As we got more attention, we made the intentional decision to limit the group to just the wider metro area and not try to be statewide or national, even though we got requests for that, because we wanted to be a real community of support and connection and accountability within which we actually know each other, right? So we intentionally stayed metro. And as Principal Frieslaven would say, having a coalition behind and around you is important when risking one's career for racial equality. So I'll give you a couple of examples of what that work looks like when we talk about working toward our stated goals. For me at Washburn, one piece is working directly with students on desegregating. Washburn is a majority white school, but very racially diverse. And our students are very aware that our advanced college credit bearing courses are much, much whiter than the school as a whole. And I have a group of students, they call themselves Integrate MPS. It works as an after school activity. And we're working on how to desegregate within those courses. The students have had, as I've worked with them to help empower them, they've had a panel with all the advanced teachers. They've surveyed the whole entire school about experiences in advanced classes. They're putting together a forum for the students to be able to speak, and they're working on actions. And so not just listening to student voice and voices of color, but actually empowering students and students of color in particular to really create change. So that's one piece of how that can look like. Another piece is response to crisis. An example was in January, on January 6th, the day of the insurrection in Washington, D.C. That night, I received a whole bunch of emails from my students who were extremely upset about what they were seeing and asking, can we not have classes tomorrow? Can we just process this? Can we talk about it? What are we going to do about it? We're just overwhelmed. And so I'm in talking with them individually, but also realized I need to really address the entire student body. And so on Thursday of that week, I recorded a video that went into our Friday webcast. So every Friday we have our weekly webcast, which is like announcements. And in the video, I addressed directly what students were seeing. And I used the words white supremacy, and I used the words domestic terrorism, and addressed explicitly from a Minneapolis perspective that we were seeing police operate very differently than we had been seeing in our hometown, and that hurt to see. And acknowledging that if kids were feeling some kind of way about that, we get it, and we feel that as the adults as well. And just encouraging kids to realize that we all respond differently though, right? Even if we're seeing the same thing, some people wanna talk, some people wanna process quietly, right? And to give each other a lot of space and grace in the coming days. That video was received well by teachers and students, and particularly when you think about the work of professional development with teachers, which Principal Jackson will discuss in more depth, but It gives teachers permission to say the words. If I say white supremacy, then teachers say, okay, now I have permission. I can say white supremacy. And students appreciate that as well. Who didn't appreciate it were some parents and community members, and that was to be anticipated. And that's where the notion of good trouble comes in, that I know I need to take the risk and do what's right for my kids of color and my community, even if I can also predict that what would happen, what did happen would happen. I did have a parent leave me a voicemail calling for my job, saying you will never, you know, don't talk this way again or I will come and get you. Alumni calling, alumni who give us a lot of money in one case, saying, hey, don't agree with you, not okay. And so knowing that we're walking into moments of risk, that not everyone is gonna agree. And knowing that the reality of racial equity work is that our communities of color have been angry for a long, long time, and we just carry on. And so we need to be allow for white communities to be angry, and we carry on differently to better educate everyone. And so that's sort of a fundamental piece of that. I will share with you one thing that really heartened me from that experience. One of my younger staff members wrote to me after that video and said, thank you so much for putting words to that. And in particular, thank you for calling out domestic terrorism. This is the first time I've ever heard a leader call a white person a terrorist. And as a Muslim person, that's been really hard for me over all of my schooling ever since 9/11. I feel like I've been on the defense about that terrorists are always look like me. And he said, my third grade self thanks you. And this is from an adult, right? But this is what it means to be an ally and to be in that work. So those are just some examples. At this point, I'm going to turn over to Principal Sheree Jackson to give a couple of her examples and share what we are asking from you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Principal Palmer. Appreciate that. Principal Jackson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Sheree Jackson, and I am the principal.
Principal Jackson, you're breaking up a bit. Would it be okay if we maybe turn off your video? Your sound might come through a little better.
Yes.
Okay.
Is that better? Hello.
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay, I'll start over. Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Sheree Jackson, and I am the principal of and I am so happy to be here. Can I just say, when our colleagues were speaking here about cultural competency?
I'm sorry, Principal Jackson, we're still having a difficult time hearing you. I wonder if you could perhaps get closer to your computer, or if you're using a mic, put it very close to your mouth.
All right, I will try. Sorry about the technology. Is this better? Is this better?
That sounds better, yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Principal Sheree Jackson from Robbinsdale Middle School in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, and we are happy to be here. I did put in the chat just the quote from Mr. John Lewis about get in good trouble, necessary trouble, and help redeem the soul of America. And it was so refreshing to hear our colleagues speak about the information that they are doing and the work that they're doing in their district. And I salute them for that. So just to give you an idea of why we depended on ourselves as a coalition to start really addressing situations has a lot to do with the achievement gap that we're seeing between whites and blacks. Black indigenous people of color, particularly blacks, we have the second worst achievement gap in the state of Minnesota for our black children. So that is something that we take very seriously and that we wanted to address. So in coming to that, we wanted to give you just more information about how that comes to you. So if you can think of the picture of what it looks like, and I'm putting it in the chat as well, to have equality in education. and what that looks like, not only to have equality, but to have equity. And not only to have equity, but access to that equality and equity to bring about the liberation and the justice that our students and our families need. So we wanted to make sure that as we started talking to our staff members, that we used all of our faculties to call out racial disparities, that we used our information to make sure that they understood that they needed to be vulnerable in some situations. So some of the things that we've been doing at Robbinsdale Middle School to create good trouble and to do anti-racist learning and teaching is we are working with building assets, reducing risks, which is the BAR program. And I do believe that a representative will be speaking regarding BAR in this call as well. And we do it school-wide, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, which is new for our school and also new for middle schools in general. It's a very costly program, but the benefits of bringing all students and all of their strengths to the table weekly ensures that our educators and our staff members think about every child and how they can enhance the best in them daily. So we leave no child out in our conversations, and it's a team approach to rethinking education, our relationships with our students and families, looking at implicit bias and how we can call that out so that it does not become something that is the vicious cycle that we have known in our schools up to date. Another thing that we're doing with Robbinsdale Middle School is anti-racist staff professional development. So this also is a direct reaction to the incidents that happened with George Floyd being murdered on national television and with all of the unrest that came with the George Floyd murders and how a lot of my students who are from the north side of Minneapolis were directly impacted by the unrest. Not only were my students directly impacted, but a lot of my staff members were directly impacted because they also live in Minneapolis. So we wanted to make sure that as we were causing good trouble, that we called that out in our relationships with one another and had conversations with ongoing professional development. Now, as an African-American female from Chicago with roots in Mississippi, third generation educator who is, as my parents always said, one generation from the cotton fields. They were always clear to let me know that I was one generation from the cotton fields of the Jim Crow South. Leading this work, this anti-racist staff development, has been a heavy lift. It's been emotionally draining and it's been triggering on so many levels because I'm asking people to be vulnerable in front of their peers. I'm acknowledging their complicity in racist practices as well as mine. And we need to work towards allyship and advocacy in these groups so that our students and staff can treat each other differently and be vulnerable. I'm also asking that my staff members are vulnerable when they are teaching to let their students know, hey, I wasn't taught this in class. I wasn't taught this when I was in middle school, but I'm here to learn differently and learn alongside with you. And to make sure that they understand that this is a learning process. This is not something that we are doing once, but we are going to continue this good trouble work. So this professional development has grown into an ongoing professional development during our summer courses and during distance learning. Not only is it led by me, but it's led by teachers. It's led by our school culture climate team members and other staff members so that we can all just examine our commitment to being disruptors, upstanders, and all of that that comes with educational benefits for our students. So the result has been rich conversations, calling out red flags of how to identify the gaps in equity, you know, red flags with our institutionalized biases, and make sure that we are creating a space for multiple perspectives. In this work, we are adjusting our curriculum We're adjusting the way that we provide services to ensure that we continue to work with an anti-racist lens of equity in our curriculum and instruction and in the processes for providing these services to our students. And not only do we do this, but they also receive, the participants receive CEUs towards recertification in cultural competency with the option of getting board credit. So we're doing this after school, and we're doing this to really get the message out. Some things that we've done so far, we have done a white fragility book study. We've done Stamped from the Beginning, which is another book. We've done that book study. We've done Immigration Nation, which is a video study, and you can find that on Netflix, which is a deep look at the state of United States immigration. And we wanted to make sure that we use different platforms and look at additional ways to bring the voices of all of our students in. And next month, we will be reading While the Locust Slept, which is our next book study PD. And we will be collaborating with our district Indian Ed staff to get this information to our teachers and our staff members, because we want to make sure that this is a great opportunity that we're bringing out other voices from our staff and our district in our perspectives. And we want to acknowledge the abuse and the erasure that has been right in the state of Minnesota to our Native people. Other things that we're doing are community mediation and restorative services, which is a nonprofit community-based and restorative justice provider. They come to our school and they have 6th, 7th, and 8th grade groups to help us to deal with restorative practices. We are also in partnership with a group called Link for Equity, which is a study through the University of Minnesota and Emory University. And we are doing that to reduce and eliminate health disparities in our communities. We are doing affinity groups, which means that we are looking at African-American girls groups, African-American boys groups, Muslim student groups, Latinx student groups, Asian-American, and multicultural student councils. So all of those groups are running throughout distance learning. And another lens that we're doing for our staff is called Beyond the Classroom, where groups of our staff members meet after school to discuss race, discuss implicit bias and our roles in perpetuating that false narrative of white superiority. Something else that we are doing is we are doing a great job of making sure that our school support staff, our counselors, our school social workers, school psychologists, personal learning coaches, all of those people provide wraparound services to build relationships with our students. So something else that as a principal I do is to make sure that in my staff emails weekly and in my bulletins that I'm specifically giving them resources related to race, how to have conversations about race, and how to keep them informed and engaged. We have also given these resources out to our parents in our weekly newsletters and in our monthly newsletters that go home. As one of our colleagues said, this is hard work. I will just say, not only is it hard work, but it is heart work. It has to come from the heart. It has to come from a place where you really want to see change and you're willing to risk everything because you know that our students are worth it. In order for them to be successful, we have to risk what we think is comfortable and do what's in our heart to make sure that we are getting the situation in front of our teachers, that we are making sure that information is getting our staff members and our students. If I may let you know some of the things that we ask from you, or how could you help us as legislators? The number one thing that we need is leadership on racial equity. We need leadership from our legislators to set some sort of statewide expectation that we are all engaged on and that we are engaged in the work and that we have some sort of stated understanding that the work is messy, it's triggering, it's difficult, but we're all in it together. And we need that from the top. We need the tone to be set by the legislators. Put your money where it belongs, in the schools. We need to fund and have resources for anti-racist and racial equity work and for curriculum that supports the narratives of all of our students, including their histories and their lived experiences. Don't sugarcoat, don't whitewash. Another thing, the average daily membership, known as the ADM, that funding needs to be changed so that it is not linked to daily attendance. Allow us to use, as our colleague said, online platforms where kids, some of our children have been more successful and have the flexibility to learn at a different pace. Let us use that and let us not be tied to the ADM or the average daily membership so that they can work towards credit at their own pace. We need more funding, full funding for special education and our ELL population, which are our English language learners. And I heard that said loud and clear too. Our children who are receiving special education resources and our ELL population, English language learners, we need that funding so that our districts with higher numbers of students, like Robbinsdale, like Minneapolis, like the Anoka-Hennepin district, that they are receiving those services and are not at a disadvantage. Funding for more school support staff in schools so that we can fund those restorative justice and restorative practices with our counselors and school social workers and school psychologists so that our students who are in trauma on a historical and daily basis get the support that they need. In fact, I used my own building funds this year to increase the amount of FTE for our school social workers and our school psychologists. I bought more people into my building out of my own funds because of the need that my students have with trauma. And we shouldn't have to make a decision like that at the building level. The mental health crises that our students go through is unbelievable, is indescribable, and we need licensed professionals to help them meet those needs. Please, funding for reducing class sizes. If we could have smaller class sizes from pre-K all the way through high school, that would really help us to increase those soft skills, those social emotional learning skills, those restorative practices, and of course, funding for the arts. So many of our children learn differently. So give them an opportunity to learn by increasing their arts and other extracurricular activities and bring those to the forefront. How are we going to imagine school where we can have funding for additional summer educational programs and after school educational extended learning opportunities, year-round schools for opportunities to have funding for that? And in order to continue the good work for the schools like myself, for Robbinsdale Middle School, who are investing heavily into our building assets, reducing risk, our BAR programs, please provide additional funding. We don't have funding to continue the sustainability of the program. So that means I have to take funding from another source. We also have to look at full funding for our post-secondary enrollment options, known as PSEO. So there's no loss to schools from this program, but we have more funding to support our colleges in the schools and other pathways to earn college credits while our students are in high school. Standards. How are we going to make our standards so that they are reflective of what we are asking in an anti-racist thinking or teaching model? We have to make sure that we're getting advanced algebra out to children, and that we're putting children of color, Black, Indigenous, people of color in these schools, especially these higher ranking classes. And I just want to say, opportunities to recruit and retain more teachers of color. One of our representatives said it so eloquently, more representatives of Black students, when they see our children, when they see other other staff members who look like them in educational roles. That is so powerful. I graduated from a historically Black college and university. I would love to see our schools actively recruit and retain staff members from HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, grow education within our own colleges and universities to include Blacks and other people of color, and actively recruit them to stay within the state of Minnesota, because they're not staying. They're not staying. And there has to be more examination as to why they aren't staying.
Principal Jackson, I'm certainly hoping that having an alumni from a HBCU in the position of Vice President of the United States will change some of the discussion there. One quick question, or maybe two from myself, and then a quick question from Representative Thompson. You talked extensively about the staff professional development you were providing. I missed if you said it was mandatory or voluntary. If it's voluntary, two questions. One, what's the percentage of uptake you're getting from teachers in your building? And then is it also open to non-licensed staff in the building? And if so, what percentage of those staff are taking advantage of the book options and the like?
Oh, I was waiting to be recognized. Can I speak?
Oh, yes, please. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine. Yes, it is optional, but what I have found is because it has been collaborative and I have been vulnerable to say, hey, we need to do this work. We have received, I can get you the actual numbers, but our staff members, not only our licensed staff members, but our educational support staff members, our paraprofessionals, they join these classes. Our district liaisons have asked if they can join the classes because we are opening it up to everyone. We want everyone to know that we are causing good trouble by calling out the things that we need to do for our students. And we have received so many asks as to when we are going to start our next book study, which I said is When the Locust Slept, which is written by a Minnesota elder and his experience in the Owatonna State.
Excellent, thank you.
So yes, that is something that we are doing.
Representative Thompson, brief question, please.
Real quick question, Chair, thank you. This to Principal Jackson. I'm familiar with CMRS. I know you mentioned CMRS. I'm familiar with, I think it's Beth Bailey, who's over at CMRS, and the work that CMRS does with within the school system, which is I hear nothing but good things. I was wondering how successful is that program over in your area? Because I do know they do work in Brooklyn Park also, but I hear nothing but good things about CMRS. So I was just wondering how good and how hard is it when you talk about financing, is that a problem? I mean, because I think that work is definitely work that's needed throughout all of our school districts.
Principal Jackson?
Yes, we have been working with our redesign committee as well in Robbinsdale Area School by Melanie Hanson, has worked with us to write grants so that we can fund CMRS. So that has been very beneficial. And the circles that we've done with restorative practices and with coaching around giving student voice has been phenomenal. This is our third year with our community of CMRS, and our staff members asked for them to come back and our students asked for them to come back. They meet Wednesday, every Wednesday, even during distance learning with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. It is when it's in school, when we are in, face-to-face, we have a room set up that is specifically for them to create their circles and to create a like environment. It's a very welcoming situation, and all of our students get a chance one period a week, one block a week, to go in with their teacher and practice circles and restorative practices. And so much conversation has come out. Students have been very forthcoming with how they feel that they have been treated by European American staff members, bringing up the discriminatory practices and the racist statements that have been made in classes. And we have dealt with those by having restorative circles so that they can repair the harm. Because if the student is saying that this happened to that person, then that is the student's perception. And it is important that as staff members, we acknowledge that that happened and that we repair the harm and do better so that it does not happen again. And call out that we are working together collectively. So it's been very successful.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Chair Dabney, you're muted.
It's so hard to know. Representative Thompson, thank you for the question. Principal Piper, Principal Jackson, thank you both very much for being here today and presenting. One of the themes I picked up on is the importance of all of us being willing to get to places where we're not comfortable, and that this is the time to do that. So thank you very much for the powerful testimony. A great way also to kick off Black History Month here in the committee. I want to pivot now to our last presentation for today with the Barr Center, Minnesota born and opportunities here with Christina Ritter, who's the Associate Director of Strategic Initiatives, a trainer and a coach with the Barr Center. Ms. Ritter, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Hello, members of the committee. My name is Christina Ritter, and I'm honored to call myself an educator. I have 28 years of experience in public education. For 4 years, I taught life science and biology to 7th and 9th grade students. And for 24 years, I've served in campus and district level administrative positions. My experiences include elementary and high school principal, assistant superintendent, and chief academic officer in a large urban school district in Texas. I joined the Barr Center, which stands for Building Assets, Reducing Risks, in 2019 as a Barr coach and trainer, and I've coached schools all over the nation, including California, West Virginia, and Minnesota. In my current role as the Associate Director of Strategic Initiatives, I coach a school, coach other Barr coaches, and oversee the implementation of Barr in 180 schools in 118 districts. I'm joined today by the founder and executive director of the Barr Center, Angela Jarabik. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm honored to be here and appreciative that the committee is focusing on innovative solutions to transform school climates. This reality is at the center of everything that Barr does, and it is one that is often overlooked in the conversation about improving our education system. In my time with you today, I'd like to give an overview of the history of Barr, an explanation of the Barr model, the positive outcomes of our work, and share the transformational story of one of our Barr schools here in Minnesota. The Barr story began in Minnesota school in 1998, and to date is the most rigorously researched secondary model in our country, with 12 within randomized controlled trials and 66 between school studies. Every school has seen academic and social emotional learning outcomes within the first year of implementation. The Barr model was developed in response to an identified need. Too many students were failing classes. Fast forward to 2021, and what was founded in one school in Minnesota is now in 18 states, 118 districts, 180 schools, and has served over 100,000 students across the nation. In Minnesota specifically, we are in 35 schools, 35 middle, high school, and elementary schools, and are reaching over 41,000 students across the state. It's important to highlight that every Barr school has seen notable changes in their first year of implementation, including decreased failure rates, decreased discipline referrals, and increased attendance. These changes occur because BAR is a transformational model that causes systems level change. So what exactly is BAR? Our model was developed by an educator within the school system and confirmed to be effective by third parties. It is a professional development and coaching model in which we train the school staff through a three-year engagement. As a result of weekly or biweekly coaching calls, monthly professional development, and supplemental training, which includes effective team meetings, substance use trauma, and equity, schools are able to carry on and sustain the work. At BAR, we believe each and every student has the right not only to an education, but a right to success in education. Through systems change, BAR is able to remove barriers that affect student progress and has been successful in closing the opportunity gap both in Minnesota and across the country. BAR improves outcomes by changing teacher and student attitudes and beliefs. In BAR, we first focus on educator beliefs. When educator beliefs change, we see adult behaviors change. Consequently, when we see a change in the adult behaviors, students' beliefs also change as well as their behaviors, all of which yield academic outcomes. Typically in schools, when addressing academic outcomes, educators begin with academic interventions rather than adult beliefs. For instance, if I want to change my math scores at a school, I would usually start with changing the math curriculum. Instead, I needed to start with a focus on teachers' beliefs and behaviors. BAR is also built on two key pillars: positive intentional relationships, staff to staff, staff to student, and student to student, and data, both quantitative and qualitative. At BAR, we believe relationships should never be a byproduct of education, but an essential and intentional prerequisite for academic success. BAR's tagline is same students, same teachers, better results. We know systemic change yields the biggest impacts, and that is why we are a K through 12 model. We also know that you cannot have great teaching, great learning, and great academic success unless you adjust the structure of school so that it's possible for adults to understand and respond to every single student as both a learner and a person. And it is possible to do just that. Recently, John King Jr., the former United States Secretary of Education and President of EdTrust, participated in a virtual conversation with Angela Jarabik, our Executive Director. And he was cited as saying, the BAR model reflects the convictions that all students can excel regardless of race, zip code, or family income when they are provided with the right supports. So what does this all look like inside of a school? So I would love to take the opportunity to showcase South St. Paul High School and South St. Paul District. Although we could put a spotlight on any of our schools, I would like to specifically talk about them. So let me begin by giving some local context and school demographics. Even though South St. Paul is in the Twin Cities metro area, the people who live there tell us it's more like a small town. The demographics include 56% white students, 28% Hispanic, 7% Black, and 7% two or more races, and 46% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch. In addition to the success they have experienced, we are highlighting South St. Paul because they have chosen to go district-wide with the BAR model as a result of transformations they have witnessed during their years of implementation. South St. Paul High School started implementing BAR with 120 students in 2017 and is now implementing K through 12 with over 3,000 students. The schools involved in implementation include Kaposia Education Center, Lincoln Elementary, and South St. Paul Middle School, which all began implementing in 2020. South St. Paul High School used the 2016-2017 year as a planning year and started implementation in the 2017-2018 school year. BAR coaches each school on how to use interlocking strategies to build intentional relationships and utilize real-time data to achieve their goals. The BAR teachers at South St. Paul meet as a collective team, review their students' data, implement interventions for students and with students, and they keep both pillars, relationships and data, in the front of their minds to ensure the development of authentic, strength-based relationships with their students and one another. And how does this strength-based approach translate into improved student outcomes? In the 5 years South St. Paul has been implementing PAR, they have reduced the failure rate, increased attendance and graduation rate, and most importantly, improved the school climate. Failure rate for the first cohort of ninth grade students continues to decrease. In the 2017-18 school year, the group's failure rate was just over 52%. After 2 years under the BAR model in the 2019-20 school year, the group's failure rate was just over 28%. This is a failure rate decrease of nearly 46%. In addition, the number of in and out of school suspensions from the 17-18 academic year was 168 incidents. After 2 years of BAR implementation, this number of suspensions fell to 50 occurrences. This equated to a 70% decrease in suspensions at the school over the course of 2 years of BAR implementation. The average daily attendance rate has also improved from 81% to 86% from the 18-19 school year to the 19-20 school year. This is a nearly 7% increase. Since they've started implementing BAR, South St. Paul students consistently outperform their peers in the state average in graduation for all students and state average for Hispanic students, and close the graduation gap at the school for their Hispanic students. As a former high school principal, I find that data really very recognizable, that is something to be applauded. BAR Center received funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to work with a limited number of schools. And South St. Paul was part of that project and joined in 2019 and 20. I'd like to share a few quotes from the staff who received training about BAR and share their insights. One member said, "I'm invested 100% in BAR because I've seen it work." Another staff member stated, "BAR taught me that teacher teamwork is key for helping students know there is an entire team working on their behalf, an entire team." BAR also works in tandem with existing programs at each of our schools. Angie Ryder, who is the BAR coordinator, worked to make sure BAR was aligned to South St. Paul's International Baccalaureate program. An interesting note, in 2021, BAR was featured on the IB Matters podcast featuring the BAR Center. I would be remiss if I did not talk about the effects of the pandemic. During the pandemic,
You're right. You would be remiss not to. however, we've only got a few minutes left in the hearing. So,
okay.
Focus all right. In and complete your...
So I would... They continue to develop and build relationships with their staff and were able to, with their students, and were able to reach out to each and every student. I would sum up this by saying our goal is for every school community to experience similar successes to those experienced by South St. Paul High School, and we believe the BAR model would help every school in Minnesota. It's been subjected to multiple testing. It is a proven model, and what we have found won't shock the members of the committee. By paying attention to students' lives, we can change the trajectory of their lives, both inside and outside of the school building. Thank you again for the incredible opportunity to testify today and to hear how BAR operationalizes relationships and uses data to transform schools. BAR fundamentally changes the way schools work and humans interact. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for that, Ms. Ritter. We have one brief question from a member, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation, BAR. I always have liked your program, but my question is, for those 32 schools in Minnesota who are part of BAR, how do they fund the program? Did you offer scholarship or please explain that.
Ms. Ritter.
Angie, it would be all right if I allowed Ms. Jerebeck to take that question.
Yeah, that'd
absolutely
be great.
Ms. Jerebeck, welcome to the committee. Good to see you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Angela Jerebeck, and thank you for this opportunity. Representative Erickson, it's been a variety of
opportunities, most of the schools came as part of the research study. So the federal funding that came in that has been doing this, they funded over 100 and plus schools, and many of them have been in Minnesota. We have had a number of our schools starting to use some integration funds to be able to implement BAR. There are a number of funding opportunities that I think that we can continue to explore, but the majority of our schools have had external funding. Although Anderson Windows has also been funding a number of schools. We've had some philanthropic private organizations step forward.
Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. To all of the testifiers today, thank you so much. This has been a powerful day of looking at issues around race and equity and relationships and how we can work systematically to respond to the racial disparities in Minnesota schools and create greater opportunity for the students in those schools, greater opportunities for professional development and experience for the staff in those schools, and a better future for Minnesota. So I want to thank you all for taking your time today to participate and to share your insights and your wisdom. Tomorrow, to continue these conversation, we will be looking at more deeply at the issue of teachers of color and Indigenous teachers in our schools. And I look forward to that conversation. With that, thank you all again. We are adjourned.